Welcome to Geopolitical Horizons, the podcast from geopolitics.com. Geopolity will soon be publishing its annual report on the 2nd of January, Strategic Estimate 2024. Our analysts have been working hard following the key events in the past year, pursuing the trends and the patterns in order to give you their analysis and insight. I've had the privilege of getting a preview of the report, and I have Geopolity founder Adnan Khan here with me to discuss this report. How are we keeping, Adnan?
I'm good, Yusuf. How are you doing?
Yeah, very good. Now, it's always a very exciting time at Geopolity when this strategic estimate comes out. I know I've found it very useful. I guess the first question is, what's the theme of the report this year?
So you shouldn't be surprised. The theme is obviously Palestine. Until the 7th of October, I mean, we sat down with the team around September time, which is usually when we start gathering our thoughts, start deciding, you know, what are the main events that have taken place during the year, what we want to address, what we feel should be addressed. So when we first sat down, it was clearly going to be the Ukraine war. Really, at least for a month or so, it was actually the Ukraine war, which was going to be the main theme. But obviously, after the events of 7th of October, probably the main event of the year, the main event in terms of scope, size, and implications is Palestine. So that's the theme we're going with this year.
It's been over 2 months since the events on 7th of October, and it doesn't seem like it's dying down anytime soon. Where do things currently stand?
So, Yusuf, it's been over 2 months now since the events of 7th of October, and what we've seen is a physical intervention by Israel. Obviously, everyone's seeing the images, hospitals being bombed, everyone's seeing residential areas being bombed. You know, people are watching a massacre take place, and they've actually been horrified. It also seems on this occasion, Israel's really struggling with its information war. Israel's really struggling to justify and explain what it's doing, why it's doing. And, you know, people are watching the images and they're absolutely horrified. What we also seen after 2 months, Yusuf, is an Hezbollah intervention, an Iranian intervention hasn't materialized. In fact, they have to some degree washed their hands of what's going on. And for the moment, no one can really see any end in sight. There seems to be some info coming out of Washington that by the end of the year, early next year, there needs to be some sort of drawdown in terms of what Israel's doing. But Israel being very clear, it's in a long war. It's going to go on forever. So in the report, we do have a look at this flare-up and we look at the history of the issue, the Palestinian issue, and a lot of the arguments around it.
How has this affected US and Israel relations? And how's it looking for Biden as a result in US?
So what we're seeing is really two things. We're seeing publicly America, the White House, they are with Israel. As soon as the events of October 7th happened, America was like, Israel has the right to defend itself. We are with Israel. We've seen America supplying Israel as well. But alongside that, what you're seeing is quite a few differences between American officials and Israeli officials. So Israeli officials were talking about a full-scale invasion. They were talking about throwing the Gazans into the desert. And what you're finding is this is going against how America sees the region. So America has actually been forcing Israel to temper down its... So we haven't seen a full-scale invasion. What we've seen is incursions, and obviously what we've seen is a huge air campaign by Israel. What we're also seeing is differences in terms of what's the overall solution. So Netanyahu has made clear that Israel will deal with security and it will run Gaza afterwards, whilst what we're hearing from Washington is no, the Arab rulers, the regional Arab rulers, or the UN peacekeeping force will really deal with the aftermath of what's going on. So you are really seeing differences emerge, and I think these differences will probably get wider as this goes on.
I do feel Biden is losing a fair bit of support over the incidents in Palestine. How's it looking like for Biden? What's his report card looking like?
So I think, Yusuf, when we look at this, it's important we look at the context in when Joe Biden came to power back in 2019, 2020. And if you remember, the context was the Trump team was arguing the election had been stolen. All his supporters, Trump supporters, are arguing the election was stolen. And really, the four-year term of Trump had really damaged America's global position. So when Joe Biden came into power, his whole campaign promise was he would repudiate what Trump's been doing. he will fix the problems Trump created. And really, he was going to make America First a legacy issue rather than a policy position for him. So his whole aim since he came to power was really to restore America's global image. So you find that America rejoined the Paris Climate Accords. It rejoined the World Health Organization. Trump had abandoned COVID-19. He said it was a conspiracy. Biden completely reversed this and he released a lot of funds to deal with vaccinations and treatments. On foreign policy, what Biden's done, Yusuf, he's continued with a lot of the Trump administration's policies despite his electoral campaign saying he will do the opposite. So very quickly, the Biden administration also confirmed that their foreign policy will be based on great power competition. This was in the national security strategy. China is the biggest challenger. And in fact, Yusuf, when we have a look, when we look at China, really Biden's continued with Trump's policy of aggressively accounting and aggressively dealing with China. Probably the most aggressive move America made under Biden was to put an embargo on semiconductor chips when it comes to China. So very quickly, when the Ukraine war started, Joe Biden created a global coalition against Russia's invasion of Ukraine. However, we see he did quite a few U-turns as well. So we see when Biden came to power, he said he wants to make Mohammed bin Salman, MBS, the Crown Prince of Saudi, a pariah. This was in light of what happened with the journalist Jamal Khashoggi, his murder. But you find eventually he did a U-turn on this. And at the moment, MBS and Saudi are in a very close relationship with America. Biden ended the Afghan war, and he will probably always be remembered for the bungling withdrawal from Afghanistan. And also what Biden started was he completely departed from the Trump policy in Iran, and he began negotiations with the Iranians. It's been quite a stop and start because of the Republicans in Parliament. So overall, Yusuf, the way Biden's scorecard looks after his first term is he's repaired relations with US allies, he's pushed Russia into a corner, he's restored relations with Europe, and he's working to contain China. So gone are the regular tweets, insults, and conspiracies of the Trump era. And what you have now is strategy, democracy promotion, and policy. But despite all of this, Yusuf, despite all these achievements, Joe Biden is the second most unpopular president in modern US history. And this is probably going to have quite a big impact as it goes into election year.
Yeah, with him being the second most unpopular president, what do you think his chances are against Trump in a rematch? Because obviously Trump is very popular.
Yes, that's correct. That's correct. It's quite polarized. Normally, Yusuf, this will be quite a straightforward question. You look at the polls, you look at public opinion, but America just doesn't work like that anymore. What you find is politically the country is polarized and you're seeing quite weird coalitions and opinions emerge. So what you find is there's many people who are critical of Joe Biden. They think he's not even there mentally. And for them, how on earth can we vote for Joe Biden when he's not mentally there? So you've got many people who would normally vote Democrat said they're going to vote Trump because at least he's there. Then you've got loads of Trump supporters who are a cult. And their view is we need to get Trump back into power and he needs to complete what he started in his first term, which is dealing with the deep state and dealing with corrupt politicians. So at the moment, the primary should be completed by the end of February. Trump is completely ahead of everyone else. So it's likely he will become the Republican candidate, which is interesting. But I mean, the Republican Party now is really the Donald Trump Party. And on the polls, both are neck and neck. So it's going to be quite a close election again, which raises the issue again, Yusuf, that whatever the outcome is, if Trump loses, it's likely his supporters will say the election was rigged again. And in fact, for the last 4 years, that's all Trump's been saying. The election was stolen. There's a left-wing plot against him. I feel this election is going to be very divisive. And, you know, unprecedented territory is probably the understatement of the century. We're probably going to have to coin new terms, really. And probably this is going to have big impact on American foreign policy. It's a very divisive election. How much can America be focused on global issues? So I think the first point of call is let's see how the primaries turn out. And then you've got 8 months of a clear presidential campaign. And it's very likely, Yusuf, even if Biden wins, he won't finish his term because he's going to be 82, the oldest president. And there's a good chance his vice president, Kamala Harris, could become president going forward, which itself raises loads of other issues. So definitely something to watch in 2024.
In the report, we discussed the US-China tech war. What were the findings?
Okay, so a tech war can actually take place in different ways. In the case of the US and China, what we're talking about is America ensuring China doesn't get access to high-tech, new emerging technologies. It's about keeping Chinese industry away from the future generation of technologies. And it also means is you have to close every avenue China potentially has of accessing them. So for this, the US obviously can't be supplying China. And that's why we see now that there's a ban in place in terms of exporting advanced chips to China. It also means the US needs to ensure other nations, its own allies, don't export to China or give her access. So we've actually written, and I think we did a podcast earlier during the year about semiconductors, and it's a very complex supply chain. And a lot of the supply chain is outside America, but because these companies have a presence in America, America can enforce things upon them. So the trade war in terms of tariffs, that was started by Trump. And what Biden has done is he's done a open ban on the country. The other strategy America's had is decoupling. And this is about curtailing links with China more than just technology. So what we're seeing is even professional financial links, these are now being targeted by America, and they're targeting their own companies and their allies' companies as well. From the Chinese perspective, Yusuf, China has a broad-ranging and robust strategy to acquire technology. And it's been taking shape really for nearly two decades now. So it's not like China has emerged as a technology hub in the last 5 years. It's been really at this for the last two decades. So the US is not dealing with a new emerging nation. It's actually dealing with a nation who actually has got its own capabilities, and these are only growing. So China, Yusuf, has been using acquisitions, espionage, and cyber theft to leapfrog technology development. And it's actually made major advances, and in some areas actually ahead of the US when it comes to AI, 5G, and quantum computing. China has a Made in China strategy, which is Made in China 2025 and then Made in China 2027. And the aim here is that the next generation of technologies, China wants 50% by 2025 to be made in China. And then by 2027, it wants 70% of this all made in China. However, finally, Yusuf, when we're looking at tech wars, really the odds and the history are against the US. And the reason why, Yusuf, is if we look at history, China really in history was a technological leader in silk, in porcelain, in tea. And China would export these very selectively. And the Europeans all wanted to steal the blueprints for this. And over time, they were able to. Once you've created a technology, once you start selling it, inevitably it will get out. Same thing, America did this with the British Empire. So when technology, you know, at the end of the day, when a company makes a technology, it wants to sell it, wants to export it. And as you export it, you know, depending on what your strategy is, you can get access to these. And over time, you can reverse engineer and learn the blueprint. So I feel in the long run, America is in a losing battle, no matter what restrictions it puts. Really, technology will get to other people. It's just a question of will it take centuries, or will it take decades, or will it take years? And what America is doing is impacting how long it will take. The fact that China will acquire technology, I don't think there's anything they can do. China's already acquired a lot of technology. So in many ways, this tech war in the long run, America is in a losing battle.
On top of America being in a losing battle with China, they're also facing a debt time bomb. There's a section in the report about this. What were the conclusions?
So this was quite an interesting section, Yusuf. For the team, we had quite a lot of discussion, and we really took this chapter from the perspective of let's actually do a deep dive from a neutral position and look at America's debt. So let's put our preconceived ideas to the side as we look at the issue. And some of the findings are quite shocking. America's debt in September reached $33 trillion. America's GDP is only $25 trillion, so the debt is actually more than their GDP. The annual debt interest repayments now exceed $1 trillion. So from America's budget every year, $1 trillion is going towards debt repayment, which isn't going towards education and health. Now, a lot has been made out of the foreign ownership of America's debt. But what we found is 70% of America's debt is held within the US. It's held by American banks, the Federal Reserve, American departments and American officials and Americans. Only 22% of Americans' debt is held by foreign investors. So despite all the media coverage China gets that it holds American debt, it's got this nuclear bomb option where it could sell America's debt, really China's ownership of American debt is very small. And China has actually been selling American debt, and it's not had any impact on America. Our main conclusion was, is as long as the dollar remains the global currency, people will want to always hold American debt. Now, the problem for America is it's more immediate, which is that the debt has to be repaid every year. And as the yearly repayments increase, it means that that money can't be spent on other parts of the American economy. So the impact of a big debt is the fact that education, health, infrastructure, these will never be a priority compared to debt interest repayment, because the day America doesn't repay any part of its debt, confidence will go, the American economy and purchasing its debt. So I think this section was quite revealing in terms of what the truth is, but this debt is only going to increase now, and that's why you find the debt ceiling debates in Congress are getting really, really heated now. So in the long run, this doesn't bode well for America in the long run.
It's been almost 2 years since the Ukraine war started. I remember discussing this with you last year and how bad it was going for Russia at the time. 1 year on, are they doing any better?
So yeah, 1 year, Yusuf, is a long time, especially in war, and it's completely different now. This time last year, I remember we were talking about how bad Russia started, how many errors it made, will it be able to turn this around? And yeah, a year later, as we come to the second year anniversary, Russia is on top. Russia's turned it around. Effectively, so what Russia did is it accepted its dash to Kiev. Its blitzkrieg tactics didn't work. And what it's done is adapted, has moved its troops around, and it's got more entrenched, and it went on the defensive. And as a result, Ukraine struggled to make any headway in its counteroffensive. And as the winter season sets in, Russia has got, 20% of Ukrainian territory. Ukraine hasn't succeeded in regaining any more territory. And what you're hearing from Washington and London and Paris and Berlin is Ukraine needs to start negotiating with Russia. So Ukraine will not be negotiating from political strength. Russia will. So really, Russia's done what it's always done. It starts wars badly, and then it adapts and it makes necessary changes. And in the long run, it usually wins. And that's really where we are, nearly 2 years into the war.
Yevgeny Prigozhin, the Wagner leader, he became a bit of a global celebrity back in June. 6 months on, how do things look now?
So 6 months on, things look very different, Yusuf. I think it was in June where he did his attempted coup. And the West were really excited. It's probably the biggest development during the war. You know, in a war, if there's a leadership challenge, it completely messes up the war effort. And that's what the West were hoping. But what we now know 6 months down the line, Yusuf, is the West completely blew out of proportion what happened and also the impact. Putin is still in power. Putin's regime is still in power. Putin's support base is still in power. And Prigozhin is gone. He died in some very mysterious circumstances in his plane that crashed. And really, 6 months on, Yusuf, Wagner, his paramilitary group, has been subsumed into the Russian military. So 6 months on, Yusuf, this is a main dot in the two-year war. I think in the future, when we look back at the war, Wagner will get probably no mention at all, because his impact was very small. At the time, it seemed like a very big deal. You know, the West got really excited. They thought this is someone finally challenging Putin. But yeah, 6 months on, so we can see actually it's just a mere dot in the timeline, and actually it's had no impact on the war.
That's a very interesting point. It does seem that way. It's quite an insignificant incident in the grand scheme of things. With Russia now ploughing on, what's, in terms of its global power projection, how is it looking?
So not too much has changed, Yusuf, in the last year or so. Russia was a country that believes it should be seen as a global power. It should be respected as such. And it invaded Ukraine, and it keeps saying that because you kept challenging our claim to Ukraine, we have to teach you a lesson. So a number of things have happened in the last year. Firstly, we see Armenia has lost a war against Azerbaijan. Russia wasn't able to come and help it and save it. In the Caucasus, Yusuf, Russia always backed Armenia and Turkey backed Azerbaijan. And Azerbaijan completely rooted out Armenia in a war. So that's not a good look for Russia. We see the Central Asian state are building more and more relations with the European countries. Obviously, with Putin bogged down in Ukraine, the Central Asian states have got a bit of leeway now to get out of the grip of Russia. And what we see is Russia abandoned the Green Deal, and this actually lost it quite a bit of credibility on the international scene.
What did happen with the Green Deal? How come Russia didn't renew it?
So when the war started, Yusuf, Ukraine and Russia, they are one of the two largest suppliers of grain. and a lot of their grain goes to quite poor countries in Africa, in the Middle East. So when the war started, this had a big impact on grain getting to the international markets. As a result, the UN and a chunk of the world, they agreed a grain deal where there will be a corridor from Ukrainian ports where ships can get grain and get them to international markets. And for countries like Egypt, South Africa, this is very important because the war started, you can't get grain out, and this meant grain prices went through the roof. And in countries like Egypt and the Middle East, the price of grain is absolutely critical. So the initial agreement was agreed for a year. But what Russia found is a lot of the European countries were buying up this grain and then selling it on to the Far East. So it wasn't even going to countries like Egypt and poor countries that needed it. So when the agreement was up for renewal, Putin made very clear that, hold on, when we made this deal, it was in return for Russian companies being taken off the ban list, and it was in return for some terms. What's happened here is Russia has been sticking to the grain deal, but the West hasn't been sticking to their side of the deal. So many Russian companies are still on the ban list. They're still on the sanction list. Some of them can't even get access to SWIFT. So as a result of that, what he realized is he's been done over. So he's basically said that we're not going to renew the deal. And what we'll do is we'll do bilateral deals with other countries that want the grain, Egypt, South Africa, these sort of countries. So this did have an impact on Russia's credibility. However, you know, as the months have gone on, Russia's just been doing direct deals with countries that need grain rather than having an international deal. So although on the battlefield, Russia's looking stronger, overall, Russia's image isn't improving. You know, you could question, is Russia really a global power? Can't even win in a war on its border, but that's where Russia is at the moment.
China's real estate sector saw some major problems during the year with the collapse of one of its largest real estate companies. What does this tell us about China's economy? Is it actually slowing down?
So the collapse of Evergrande, which is what it was, China's largest real estate company, it really reveals that the Chinese economy has some serious structural issues. Now, Evergrande, China's real estate sector, and China's national debt, they all link to China's economic model. And this is the fundamental problem. Really, when the global economic crisis happened in 2008, China realized that this model it has of importing all the raw materials and then exporting these to the finished products to the world was in recession, so that can't continue. So what they realized is they need to change the economic model. They can't be dependent upon exports as they are. So what they did is lots of money went into real estate, lots of money went into infrastructure. This saw the emergence of loads of real estate companies. It led to a big increase in debt in the country. But what we find, Yusuf, is literally China created more towns than people that could physically live in them. So you have ghost towns in China. And the reason why they built all these towns with residential properties, but it's way more than what China needs. And this strategy was to ensure China didn't go into economic crisis at the time. So now what's happened is all the real estate companies that were involved in this, they've got loads of debt. They can't pay off the debt because people are moving into these towns. And this was a strategy to deal with the economic crisis at the time. So what this reveals, Yusuf, is China has a problem with its economic model. It tried export-driven model that came to an end in 2008. It's tried investment into one sector, into its economy. That's created all these issues. And changing your economic structure, this is a decades-long process. It doesn't happen overnight. So really, the collapse of these real estate companies, it reveals that China actually has some deep economic issues.
We hear a lot about America's containment strategy for China. In the report, there's a chapter on China's plan to counter this containment. Could you tell us a bit more about this?
So yes, so I think this is important, Yusuf, because we hear a lot about America's containment strategy, America's strategy for the Far East, great power competition. We don't really hear what's China's strategy to counter this. You know, how is China countering containment? And what we find is a couple of things is one strategy China has to counter this is economic. China is now the number one trade partner for over 130 nations in the world. There is, depending on how you define it, on 200 nations in the world. China even has close ties with American allies and partners. So we find Europe, for example, has quite a deep relationship with China. And this is causing problems with America. We see also China has been using investments, infrastructure aid and trade deals to weaken the US relations with its allies and partners. So this is one part of the strategy. The other part is it's been trying to woo Europe. Europe has been a particular focus for China. Europe China, when it looks at Europe, it sees a massive market. And what it sees is technology the Europeans need, and China feels it can actually provide it. And this would really aid China's economic development. So Germany and France, they've really been keen to develop deeper relations with China, even though this causes tension with the US. So for China, Europe is an economic opportunity. And actually, if the Europeans get on board with China, this will cause tension with America, which is exactly what the Chinese want. The other part of the strategy is standing with Russia. So from energy supplies to military technology cooperation, Russia remains a vital strategic partner for China. This is the image it wants to create. And you know, it has been expanding its relationship with Russia. And then lastly, global leader. China has been trying to project an image of global leadership. And it does this by promoting different models of governance. It does this by establishing new institutions for security, for development and finance. And all of this is so China can be seen as a global leader and an alternative pole than the US. So China successfully created an image of countering the US. But this image, Yusuf, it still remains largely an image. It doesn't really confer real influence for China over America. So one case in point is China criticizes the role of the US dollar as a global reserve currency. It keeps talking about this, but physically it's done actually nothing to do anything about it. So all of China's strategies, I think, is important. We've got to put them into perspective that whatever China says is fine, what are they actually doing as well? But what China has achieved is creating the image that is challenging America.
What about Taiwan? Where does this come into the equation? Is the time running out for China to reunify with the island?
Taiwan has elections in 2024, and I think you're right. The diplomatic, economic, political option for China to reunify with Taiwan is actually running out. The party in power at the moment is the pro-independence party, and it looks likely they're going to win the election next year, which means that the economic, political, social links that would allow unification, they're fast eroding. And what that means going forward, Yusuf, is the military option is probably going to be the last remaining option now. So Xi Jinping has already said that he wants to reunify Taiwan by 2027. And it does look as though now, with this party coming to power, going to win in the second term, that the political option really to reunify is fast eroding. And then what you're really left with is the military option. And that really creates all sorts of issues really going forward.
Let's focus on Europe. The Ukraine war seems to have dominated the politics of the continent. There's an interesting section in the report that looks at the vassalization of Europe. What are the key findings here?
So really, so the Ukraine war has revealed that Europe can't stand on its own. If you look at the war in Ukraine, really it's been led by America. America cobbled together a Western coalition. And despite all the talks of Europe standing on its own, Europe having an independent military, what you find without the US, there would actually be no Western front. And we've got to keep in mind, Yusuf, that Europe has been cutting their military budgets for over a decade now, and now it's coming to haunt them. So when you have these sort of conflicts with Ukraine or other large countries, Europe just doesn't have the military to stand up to them. Now, America's focus is more and more shifting to the Far East, and Europe's role will be more and more to support this. And I think, Yusuf, we've got to keep in mind that during the Cold War, Europe was the epicenter of the ideological battle. You had a line that runs from Norway down to Turkey, and that line was the border or the Iron Curtain between the West and the East. So Europe was quite central to the Cold War, and America supplying arms and equipment and having troops there was critical. With the war now, with the battle of the future now shifting to the Far East, what you're finding now is the European continent won't be as important. In fact, it's going to be the Far East which become more important, and the presence of Europe in the Far East is very, very small. So the US sees Europe's role in helping American technological dominance over China. And this is to be achieved by Europe yielding to US industrial policy, which is to limit their economic relations with China. Now, if Europe does that, it means that it's going to deindustrialize. It means that industrial development won't really take place. And obviously, the only other region that can technologically develop is Europe. The only other option is obviously the Far East or America. So if the Far East is dominated by China and the American continent is dominated by America, the only other pole is Europe. And what America wants is for Europe to not industrialize and technologically develop, but actually be behind America. Because if it technologically develops, it must start supplying to China. So really, America's view going forward is they want Europe to be a vassal. They want Europe to be an agent for them in their battle against China. And if Europe accepts this, then it will just become a backwater for America. So all the talk of Europe standing on its own feet, all the talk of this great future, really for the first time, what you're seeing is a great divergence on the view of the world in the future between Europe and America.
How likely do you think it will be for Europe to become a vassal for America?
So I think some countries already are, Yusuf. You find, you know, there's not one Europe. You find Britain likes to stand on its own, but when it comes to military interventions, it really needs America now. France, despite all the talk, it still needs America. Germany talks very loudly, but you find now when the Ukraine war started, they got behind America. Much of the European Union, Poland, Bulgaria, Romania, all the Eastern European countries, these were already part of America's military architecture. They've got American equipment, they've got bases. That was already the case. What you find, the French and the British were the loudest when it came to, yeah, we need to have our own military, we need to stand on our own feet. But if you look at their military reviews for the last two decades, all they talk about is shrinking their military footprint because it's too costly. They can't afford it. So what you find now, they're going to have to go as coalitions if they want to get involved in other conflicts. And that allows America really to dominate these coalitions because America has got a large military and America hasn't been shrinking its military. It's obviously been evolving its military capabilities. But I think already, you know, if you look at the Iraq war, if you look at the Afghan war, if you look at the Ukraine war, which is the war on the European continent, it's not the Europeans who are leading on this. It's actually America.
The global economy in 2023, it was dominated by two new terms, one being the global south, and the second, ChatGPT. Do you mention these in the report?
Yes, we do. We do. In the global economy section, these are probably the two most important developments of 2023. So the global south seems to be the in thing at the moment. Russia and China are always talking about the global south. They always talk about developing and deepening relations with them. And as far as the West are concerned, the future of liberal values is about taking these to the global south. Now, what the global south is in geopolitics, Yusuf, the last 500 years has been dominated by the global north. So if you look, the northern part of the earth, that's where the powers have come from in the last 500 years. So, you know, the European countries, you've got America, you've got Russia. So that's a very small percentage of the world. The rest of the world, which they call the southern part of that, the global south, what you find is during the Cold War, they were either with the Soviet Union or they were with the West. But you also had a large movement who were called the non-aligned movement, who want to stand on their own. And what you find is they try to do this with various levels of success. Obviously, if you look, the largest economies in the world have always been the global north. They are the largest traders in the world, largest financial sector and industrial sectors. What the south have is the commodities and the resources. But what you find is all the institutions since 1945 have been set up by the global north. They've been set up in line with their interests. So if you look at India, it was projected itself as the leader of the non-aligned movement. So it's neither with the global, it's neither with the Eastern camp, the communist camp, neither was it with the West. And it's come back into fashion now because the BRICS organization and China and Russia, they keep talking about winning and supporting the demand of the global south. You're talking about Brazil, you're talking about South Africa, you're talking about India, and you're talking about all the other countries that have really been on the receiving end of dominance by the liberal capitalist West. So we go through the reality of the global south. Again, there's a lot of promise, Yusuf, but on paper, how much can this turn into something tangible? That's what we assess in the report. So regarding the other main development, ChatGPT, really, I think it was the end of 2022 where the first version of ChatGPT was released, and now various other versions of it's been released. And this is a major development, Yusuf, going forward for the global economy. What ChatGPT is what they call generative AI, generative artificial intelligence. And this is where you use models or algorithms that create brand new output. So you type in something and it produces a report. You type in something and it produces photos like you get in Midjourney. You type in something and then the algorithm generates video, code, data, or even 3D renderings. So from vast amounts of data that they've been trained on, they're able to do this. So these models that generate new content by referring back to the data that they've been trained on, really allows them to make new predictions, and actually it presents some really interesting things going forward. Probably a simple way to look at this is whenever you did a Google search, Google would look at the words and it will just scroll the internet for the same words and give you the result. So hopefully on your screen, one or two of the results will fit what you want. With ChatGPT or generative AI, you can type in something and it doesn't just look for the words. It connects the word and actually answers the question or generates what you've actually asked it to do. So Adobe Firefly is one example of that. This is Adobe's AI, where you type in, you want a certain image, and then it will generate the image for you. So ChatGPT is one example of this. Now, what makes ChatGPT and other generative AI tech so disruptive is that they have the potential to perform a wide range of intellectual and non-routine tasks. So if you look at robots, Yusuf, they can do the same thing again and again and again very well. What they can't do is do different things. What generative AI can do is it can do different things and learn how to do other things. And that's why you're finding there's a lot of talk of the Terminator scenario, the AI becoming aware, and then, you know, you've got the elliptic view that will take over the world. Probably the biggest impact we've got to look at is jobs. Whenever you have a new tech arrive, industrial revolution, railways, the internet, this has a major disruption on jobs. Some industries disappear and new industries emerge. What's probably going to be quite a big issue going forward, Yusuf, is which jobs will disappear now because generative AI can do it for you. So if you look across the office, there's many, many tasks that can be given to AI. So already I've seen the other day I called a call center and you're talking to a chatbot, which is an AI. You're not talking to a physical person. So what it does, it listens to what you say, it connects your word, and it gives you an answer. So, you know, the industrial revolution transformed manual labor, and generative AI will have an impact on jobs that require knowledge. And the jobs that require knowledge are the main jobs in the advanced economies. So this is going to have a massive disruptive effect. We have a look at this in the report.
In last year's report, there was a review of where the world stood with oil, and there was a landmark announcement of nuclear fusion at the beginning of 2023. What will the impact be?
So yeah, this time last year, we had a look at where the oil industry was, and literally, I think a couple of weeks after that, there was an announcement of development in nuclear fusion. So the US Department of Energy, it announced that it had achieved fusion ignition in an experiment at the National Ignition Facility in California. And this is used for the first time scientists have achieved ignition. So this is the point at which the energy released from a self-sustaining fusion reaction is more than the energy used to create it. So that's a major development, Yusuf, because most nuclear reactors are fission reactors where you split atoms. If you can join atoms, it releases much more power. The problem was, in order to do this, it's obviously, it's new technology. It requires a lot of effort. And, you know, nuclear technology has been with us for nearly 100 years. What they've been able to do now is they've been able to get more energy out than the energy it took to achieve the ignition. So that's a major development. However, it doesn't mean we're seeing the end of fossil fuels and oil. There's still a long, long way to go. The reason why this is firstly, it's taken us over a century of research to reach a point today that this is actually possible, but there's significant technical and engineering challenges that remain. So for example, building a fusion reactor and the facility that houses it doesn't even exist yet. In fact, the blueprints to even do so do not currently exist. So getting a practical nuclear fusion reactor, which is providing electricity to a town, this is decades away still. That's where we are. So whilst there's a long way to still go to achieve commercial and sustainable fusion reactors, the early technical challenges, they've now been overcome. And the now research will focus on the infrastructure that's needed to build and maintain such a facility. So in time, Yusuf, this will have major economic implications as the level of fuel we have in the world will increase, and nuclear fusion has zero impact on the environment. So it makes it ideal fuel for the future. But none of this is possible, Yusuf, unless all these hurdles can be overcome. So my prediction is, Yusuf, if we're still alive, maybe in 2100, we will have fully functional nuclear fusion reactors. So Yusuf, if we're still around in strict estimate 2100, we can be talking about it then.
I'll see you then. There's a lot of questions about 2024, but hopefully we'll discuss this in our next podcast. check out our website for the strategic estimate. It will be released on the 29th of December. Thank you for your time today. I'm Yusuf. Thank you for listening.